Fair warning, this show contains strong language and adult themes from time to time. Sorry, Jerry can't help it.
Sick Boy Wolfgang Productions presents The Offering with Jerry Horror. A deep dive into the history of film and its filmmakers. Mostly horror, always genre.
It's always Halloween at the Haunted House of Hamburgers, Long Island's only Halloween-themed restaurant. At Haunted House of Hamburgers, they are obsessed with both Halloween and hamburgers, so why not have the best of both worlds every day? Salivate over their delicious hamburgers during Boo Brunch, along with their Witch's Brew and Crypt Keeper cocktails. Or take a stab at the undead desserts, such as Ice Cream Sundaes, with your bobbing for apple pie. My favorites are the Afterlife Alcoholic Shakes. I'd go for the Pentagram Passion Fruit, or the Exorcism Espresso Martini Shake, or my go-to, the Loch Ness Monster Lobster Rolls. This place is fun as hell. They even encourage you to come dine in, dressed in costume. Your kids will love that. Or that could be one hell of a memorable first date. They're not going to forget that, right? Here's a little insider tip. For a far-out trippy dining experience, ask your waiter for 3D glasses. It's pretty rad, let me tell you. Located at 330 Fulton Street in Farmingdale, New York, it's the restaurant that looks like a haunted house. You won't miss it, I promise. Make Haunted House of Hamburgers your year-round Halloween destination.
Stay spooky all year long at Strange Love Parlor, Long Island's exquisite oddities and curiosity parlor in Lindenhurst, New York. They've got some ghastly apparel. Strange Love Parlor supplies an array of goth jewelry, unisex horror-themed gear, Halloween accoutrement, monstrous purses and wallets, spooky pins, patches, and stickers, providing you with the most wonderful and the most strange of treasures. Visit Strange Love Parlor regularly to find the item of your dreams, or perhaps even your nightmares. Grab your ghoul gang and visit today. Strange Love Parlor in Lindenhurst, Long Island, New York. Listeners and fans of The Offering can get their hands on their very own The Offering with Jerry Horror merch, now only at Tee Public. Find your own fresh The Offering with Jerry Horror high-quality merchandise, including t-shirts, hoodies, tank tops, long sleeves, stickers, and mugs. Just like the show, we've got gear that's mostly horror, always genre. The Offering with Jerry Horror Tee Public store has everything you need to represent your favorite podcast. Folks, head on over to teepublic.com right now and pick up your very own Offering Tee today. Welcome to The Offering with Jerry Horror, the show where we can have a quiet and frank discussion as adults about the things that matter to me, or at least that I think matter to me. Please take a moment to subscribe to our show wherever you get fine podcasts, and hey, stay up to date on future episodes. Coming up, how do you make a sequel to one of the most iconic and profitable horror films of all time? The original director didn't return to this one because, quite frankly, he thought the script sucked. To this day, the film remains the most critically panned horror film of all time. The opening night of this film was so disastrous that it actually incited a riot amongst an angry audience. Strangely enough, both Martin Scorsese and Quentin Tarantino loved this film. Ladies and gentlemen, friends beyond the binary, it's me, your old pal, Jerry Horror. How you doing? Checking in, checking in. You know how we do. I'm on your radio. Do they still call them radios? I mean, it's nebulous. It could be a phone, could be a Bluetooth speaker. I feel like I'm your fucking father's age and I'm looking around Radio Shack. And I'm like, what's that? Is that a computer? No, Dad, that's a transformer. But it would be like the Radio Shack brand. It would be like Transmoofer. We got a really nice review. Producer Pete brought this to my attention. And like I had said, if you write reviews, I will read them on air, even if they're unflattering to my tiny, tiny ego. 5 stars, because you know that's how we roll. 5 stars, most enjoyable. I started late with this podcast, Beetlejuice episode. But thankfully, you can go back, listen to every past episode.
Jerry's voice is very not annoying, and the pace of the episodes are right on. You can hear the passion and enjoyment that he brings, which is important because if you don't have that, the audience can tell. Keep it up, and hopefully one day you can talk about Future Kill. Ed Zone 33. Ed, thank you for your kind words. I would love to talk about Future Kill. God, that had a great VHS cover. That's really all I remember about that movie. That's like most of the shit from the late 80s and early 90s. I remember the VHS box cover art more than I remember the movie. Thank you. This is very kind of you. We appreciate the nice reviews, you know? So don't be shy. Let us know how you feel. Even if it's not good. Even if it's not flattering. I don't care. It is what it is. I'm sorry. Pete, listen, I never bring up politics. But this shit, because it's a follow-up on our Beetlejuice episode from last year. Beetlejuice is back in the news. Well, there's going to be a Beetlejuice 2. We know that. But Congresswoman Laura Boebert, she played Find the Sausage. And she got her topside bongos bangoed. Yeah, so she was at a high school production. She was at a local touring company that was doing Beetlejuice. They tried to be cool about it. They were like, hey, listen, she was vaping and being loud and disruptive. But the real reason they threw the bitch out was because she was doing really dirty things. And I got news for you. Listen, I've done a lot of drugs. When they showed the security cam footage of her and that dude, they were on drugs. They were on coke. They were on something. I don't know what. I can't believe this is how Beetlejuice comes back into the cultural zeitgeist, is because of some terrible, terrible human being. And look, I don't know about this woman. I don't know a damn thing. Listen, I stay out of politics. I really do. But I could tell you, this she probably should not be in office. I don't know anything, but I can tell you that if you elected me, I wouldn't do that. You know, like, I have enough respect to the touring cast of Beetlejuice not to do that sort of thing. We've also got a follow-up with Cobra. This is pretty crazy. Stallone update. He basically came out and said, Cobra to me was half-baked. Could have done better. I wasn't concentrating enough. I let my ego get the best of me. Basically, what he was saying was, he regrets Cobra the most because he felt like he could have done it better. But he, you know, like the whole thing with him and George P. Cosmatos, it was one of those things where he was running the show. Listen to the episode. I go on about it. But basically what they've been telling Stallone is, they're like, listen, we want you to do another Rambo, but we want you to give some new guy or girl, because now that would be weird, right? Like, we transition into a female Rambo. But hey, whatever. Who cares? Listen, here's the thing. You can complain about equal time representation, but people got to go see the movie. So if the old grampies like me who are going to go see Rambo, I don't know. I mean, could there be it's just a bridge too far. More than most likely, though, he has a deal in place with Amazon, and they're going to do a Rambo prequel TV show. So whatever. So in that, I guess we learn how Rambo is made. Look, it is what it is, folks. So that's just some updates on previous episodes of this show. People love it when I tell stories, especially when I tell stories of my youth, because they're generally embarrassing or just terrible in one way or the other. So when The Running Man came out, I had to be the most responsible, dumb little fat kid that I could be and beg my father to go take me to see it. It was a midnight show. You know, they don't look, sometimes they still do it, but they don't do it anymore. Nobody does the midnight show thing. Now, like the Thursday before a movie comes out, you can see it at 3 p.m. Nobody cares. Nothing is sacred. Nothing special. I don't know. Maybe it's just me. So we go to see The Running Man. We get there. It's midnight. And look, it's Schwarzenegger. It's 1987. That audience is lit. They're ready. They've seen The Terminator. They've seen Conan. They've seen Commando. They're ready for some Arnold goodness. They're pumped up. A bunch of young gentlemen walk in to the theater. They sit down a few rows in front of us. And the first thing you hear, not even like 3 seconds, I don't even think their asses touch the seat, and you heard, it's like a freshly opened Corona or whatever it was. And It's whatever. People are like, all right, fine, they're having a beer. I go to the movies now. I hear it all the time. There's always some jackass who has to wait till, like, they show, like, you know, like you're watching a movie and it's like the title card comes on. It's like aliens. And the dude's like, ka-ch! It's like, all right, dude, you're cool. All right, it's 5 o'clock somewhere. Rest in peace, Jimmy Buffett. Wow, there is some fucking upset boomers somewhere. So anyway, we're in the theater. This one dude lights up a joint. I didn't even know at the time because I'm like a dumb little fat kid who's like, I want to see Arnold. This would be great. And do you think they're going to make action figures, Dad? Do you? So he starts smoking this joint and I didn't know what like angel dust was or dust, but like you could smell it. From that moment, it burned something into my brain. If you've never smelled dust, it kind of smells like burning plastic bags. It's got that really kind of toxicity to it that tingles your nose. So eventually, a few minutes later, like these guys are just, they're smoking the joint, we're drinking, they're going ape shit. You would think they just got home from World War II. It's a scene. So now they got to bring some kid out, some usher comes down. And the kid's like, hey, you know, you guys can't do that in there. And they're like, fuck you. and they basically throw like a bottle cap at this kid's head. And I'm sitting here like I'm a dumb little kid. I'm like 9 years old and I'm out at midnight with my dad. And this is the kind of shit you're going to encounter. So now that guy goes away, the little usher kid. Now this big angry manager comes out and he comes down and he was like, yo, motherfuckers need to respect the rest of the people. You can't be smoking that shit in here. He's going off. So one of the guys moons him. And I'm like, see, these are things that don't happen nowadays. It was the 80s. There's a lot of mooning going on. So he moons the guy. And they're laughing. They're drinking their cerveza. They're smoking their joint. Everything's good. And then the fucking cops show up. And I'm like, again, dumb little kid. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? So two police officers show up. And this is back in the old days. Marijuana was, it was a lot different then. They straight up handcuffed these dudes. It was like an episode of Cops. It was fucking insane. So they take two of the dudes out, like the one guy who had the joint. It's a mess. So like, there's a whole ruckus. And like, we haven't even seen a trailer yet. You know, so they take these guys, they're taking them out, and I'm just sitting there, and like, I don't even know what my dad is thinking, you know what I'm saying, like, he's kind of just rolling the punches, eating his popcorn, he's not even sweating this shit, and I'm like, Dad, what is happening, this is like some Mad Max shit to a little kid. Big manager comes back out, he's like, I'm sorry for that, blah, 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 I got free passes at the front desk when y'all leave in the lobby. And we're not going to show any trailers. People fucking erupted in this theater. It was... Listen, as much as I love trailers, you see them so many times. You know, like, before Oppenheimer came out, I saw the trailer like 100 times. That was going to see The Running Man in 1987. That's the kind of shit that would go down in theaters. It was crazy. I tell people, when I was a kid, shit seemed so lawless. It was just incredible. So yeah, hey, this season we did Last Action Hero. So if you haven't checked that episode out for some more Arnold Schwarzenegger goodness, listen, this has been a long time coming, this episode. I'm very excited to get down to business. It's one of the most infamous sequels of all time. I want you to buckle up, fasten in, maybe get yourself a tasty beverage, whatever it is that you do to get in the moment for the offering, because it's about to go down. Listen, folks, I don't make the rules, I just break them. Now, let's get down to brass tacks. Here is one of the most infamous horror sequels of all time. Let me just, oh, wait, producer Pete's not, nope, I can't tell you just yet. You're going to wait until after the break. You're going to find out. It's going to blow your mind. Years ago this December, bum, 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 The Exorcist, the original Exorcist by William Friedkin, written by William Peter Blatty, came out. We're celebrating it, baby. Got Exorcist Believer in theaters. Everybody's revisiting these films because rest in peace to our good friend William Friedkin, maverick filmmaker, a true giant in the film industry.
He passed away, which is crazy because like a week before he passed away, they were going through the 4K with him. They were going through it. They were like, hey, do you like this? How's the sound mix? And he loved it. He really liked what they did with the transfer. He was very happy. William Friedkin was a big supporter of physical media in general. He believed that it was probably one of the best things. He always said that these Blu-rays, they look better than anything that he ever shot. So he says that he would watch some of his own films on Blu-ray and then he would find these new things that he previously didn't even know existed in the sound mix, like with The Exorcist. 50 years ago, this film came out. It changed all of cinema, okay? The Exorcist is probably easily one of the top 50 films ever made. Fuck horror, fuck genres. This is such a preeminent movie for so many reasons, and it's been covered. It's been done. There is so much out there about The Exorcist. Hours and hours you could spend listening to William Friedkin or even William Peter Blatty. The stories are out there. They've been told. And shockingly, with Exorcist II, The Heretic, let me tell you something, folks. There was a making of book made the year that this came out. You can get it on eBay for like $25 to $100. And it broke down making the film. And it was officially produced by Time Warner. It was produced by the studio. And this book, usually when things were done in the 60s and 70s or the 50s, they were like flowery. It was like, oh, and this is how we did this effect. Mm-mm. This was the first book that was like, yeah, there was a lot of turmoil making this movie. So right from Jump Street, there's been so much information available because everybody who worked on Exorcist 2 has gone on record. Everybody has a different version of their story, whether it's Linda Blair, whether it's Richard Burton, Louise Fletcher, everybody's got a story. It's insane. I do think in a lot of ways that Exorcist 2 was cursed. For a lot of reasons, we will get into that. But on December 26, 1973, William Friedkin unleashed The Exorcist on an unsuspecting public. It changed the world, okay? Everybody was talking about it. It's a monoculture. People are in the know. And The Exorcist is one of those movies where people are waiting around the block. It's got the greatest buzz you can ever get, which is word of mouth. Tell a friend, tell a neighbor. Everybody was going to the cinemas. And it's crazy because it opened the day after Christmas. I think that was a marketing move too. And it also qualified it for an Oscar at that point. The novel was made in 1971. It's William Peter Blatty. Reviews, it's funny too. We go back and you look at these movies that are classics like The Exorcist. The reviews were mixed for The Exorcist. It's not like everybody's like, oh, this is an amazing film. There were a lot of people who fucking hated this movie. So you look at now like it's the institution. These movies are looked at with controversy. And then they become the most influential part of what's been created. It's one of those things, like we talked about this in the John Carter episode. Sick plug, bro. Go back and download it. Yeah, so we go and we talk about John Carter, and it had been strip mined. Whether it was Dune or Star Wars, you had already heard and seen and experienced those stories. So it becomes one of those things where, like, even The Exorcist, people don't know this. There were 30, I'm not kidding, 30 Exorcist ripoffs. A couple of them, like Abby's a good one. That's the blaxploitation one. If you haven't seen Abby, that's a good one. That's a good one. There's another one, there's a Polish one that I liked. That was good too. It's almost a shot-for-shot remake. But it spawned all of these copycats. It was incredible. Like, I don't think we've ever seen anything like that. Again, monoculture. So it's everybody is consuming the same stuff. So they're completely influenced. And it becomes like this weird incestuous thing that happens where every culture has to have their version of The Exorcist. And it's insane. Some people say that Jaws created the original summer blockbuster. I'm going to say it was The Exorcist. It was a blockbuster. People were, like I said, they were lined up for hours and hours and hours. People were passing out. There were people that screamed bloody murder running out of the theater. Scariest thing they've ever seen. That's a cultural touchstone. You can't replicate that.
It's lightning in a bottle, baby. You can't. It's like I talk about these movies like Ghostbusters. It's a perfect movie. And no matter how many sequels you make, it doesn't matter. It's the same thing with Back to the Future. It's a perfect movie. You don't need... Look, I love Back to the Future too, but you don't need it. You don't. Jurassic Park, you don't need any... That's it. It's one and done, baby. It's perfect. Now, here's the deal. Here's the real rub with The Exorcist. On a budget of $12 million, it went on to gross $428 million worldwide, which according to today's metrics would be close to $1 billion, which is absolutely insane. Now, suffice to say, when a movie makes that much money, you know, they're going to want a sequel. And sequels were much more rare in the 70s. Everybody, you know, like Friedkin's The French Connection, they got a French Connection too. And Friedkin wanted nothing to do with it. But the first one made so much money, hey, we got to see Gene Hackman, Popeye Doyle, go on some more adventures. In fact, let's have him go after a bunch of French heroin dealers that get him addicted to junk. Yes, this is the sequel to The French Connection 2. So all business aside, all money-making ventures aside, how do you follow up The Exorcist? Its cultural relevance, still, to this day, it's with us. It's an unenviable task. My personal opinion on following up films that were this influential, Empire Strikes Back is like a rare exception. The Godfather Part 2 is a rare exception where I think I'm a Part 2 guy. I think The Godfather Part 2 is better than the first movie. Just my opinion. It happens. It happens very rarely that a sequel is better. Like Under Siege 2, Dark Territory. Fantastic. Incredible. Blows away the original. No. It's okay. I like it. You know, your mileage may vary on that one. So, 9 out of 10 times, the original director is not behind the sequel. It's something that happens usually. Like now, again, it's more commonplace. Like you got Justin Lin. He made a shit ton of Fast and the Furious movies. If this was back in the day, that wouldn't have been the case. I feel like a lot of God-fearing people, especially Catholics, this audience like was the perfect prey for the original film. And because of the widespread Catholicism that was going on in the world, it basically hit a nerve with a lot of people. And at certain points in history, the Catholic Church would even ban screenings of The Exorcist. If they found out that something was coming up in their town or they were going to show it, they shut it right down, which is insane. But hey, it is what it is. I don't think that any sequel to this film could provide that type of cultural impact. Think about it. Just think about whether it's Scary Movie or it's the latest Conjuring film. You feel The Exorcist. You feel Friedkin's fingerprints on all of it. It's insane. So who would want to make a follow-up to this movie? That's a good question. We're going to get into it. Well, enter Exorcist 2, The Heretic. What is a heretic? Well, a heretic is a person believing in or practicing religious heresy. Someone who speaks out or against what is generally accepted. What is heresy? Well, it's a belief or opinion that is contrary to orthodox practices of religion. Those whom speak against the word of God. Now, these people are generally ostracized and even in some cases banished. During the Crusades, it was very popular to murder people who spoke against the word of God. So just remember, that wasn't all that long ago, kids.
In 1974, a motion picture shocked the world. It has become one of the most acclaimed and successful films in history. The Exorcist is a classic in its own time. And now, Warner Brothers takes you a step beyond. Exorcist 2, The Heretic. Starring Linda Blair, Richard Burton, Louise Fletcher, Max von Sydow, James Earl Jones. Their minds locked together with the most terrifying vision of all. Exorcist 2, The Heretic.
this film gets rushed into production, The Exorcist 2. I can't stop calling it The Exorcist 2, but whatever. You know what I'm talking about. The Exorcist comes out in 73, and then 20th Century Fox does The Omen, and it got really good reviews. That's the Dick Donner one. It was a smash hit. The Omen is huge. Because you know what? The marketplace is primed. They all saw The Exorcist. Everybody saw it. So they're like, okay, this kid is like the son of the devil. Yeah, this is cool. Let's rock with this. But it was well received. For a film that's as gory and as intense as The Omen is, critics love the shit out of that movie. It's a good movie. It's a Richard Donner movie. Even Richard Donner's bad movies, like Lethal Weapon 4, still pretty good. It's Richard Donner. The film's producers deliberately intended this film to be less graphic in content. They got the wild hair up their ass because they're saying, look, The Omen's making all this money, man. We got carte blanche to make the biggest sequel of all time. But what they figured was, see now, PG-13 didn't exist at this point in time in the 70s. It would be 84, like Red Dawn. So you either got a PG or you got an R. There was no middle ground or you got an X, you know, wink, wink. So right out the gate, they want a PG. They don't want an R rating. So you already know, because what they figured at that point was all the kids, we talk about the cyclical generational thing, where it's like all the kids that heard from their parents or their older brother and sister how crazy The Exorcist was, they would get all those little kids into the theater to see a sequel. And this is Warner Brothers. This is what they were thinking at the time. Neither William Peter Blatty or William Friedkin of the original film, they did not want anything to do with an Exorcist sequel. They said this was because they had filed lawsuits against the studio and each other. William Peter Blatty and William Friedkin sued each other over profits, credits, and Blatty, he ended up getting barred from post-production on the first film. So that put a divide between the two of them, the two Williams. Yeah, it's crazy. So these guys are not simpatico. They're suing each other. They're talking through lawyers. They want nothing to do with it, because if you know the history of the first film, it was a nightmare to make. It was a miracle that it got made and it got released. I think after going through that ordeal, nobody wanted to do it again. Now, according to the film's co-producer, Richard Ledler, Exorcist 2 was conceived as a relatively low-budget affair. What they essentially wanted to do was remake the first movie. They have the central figure, an investigative priest, interview everybody who's involved with this exorcism, and then fade out to unused footage. Like, they were going to basically repurpose footage. You know, it was going to be kind of like, previously on The Exorcist, you know, like, and they go into the whole flashback of all of, and it's like, that's one of the cheapest things you can do. When you're recycling unused footage from the first movie, you really don't have an inkling or a genesis of how to do this. And again, this is studio executives. This is not creatives. These are executives. These are bean counters that are mandating that this film get made because it's going to make them money. They said maybe like for $3 million, we could do this movie. Everybody was rolling with this plan. We're going to do a cheap remake and we're going to just throw it out there. They get this guy, William Goodhart. He was commissioned to write the screenplay, which at that point, it had no connection to The Exorcist when the screenplay was written. It was just called The Heretic. It was based around all of these theories from Jesuit paleontologists and archaeologists. They would inspire the character of Father Marin in Blatty's original novel. Now, Goodhart's screenplay took a more metaphysical and intellectual approach compared to the original film. Here, the battle of good and evil would center on human consciousness, with a specific idea within the framework of Catholic theology. Human consciousness could be brought together as one technology. So, of course, it's about the fight between good and evil, but this script dealt with where does psychology fit into the battle of good versus evil? Where does technology fit into it? So there's all these different aspects we're all asking the big questions. Is evil real? Does good attract greater evil and vice versa? So he's working on this script, and there was another script. Okay. There was an original script. All right. You ready for this? This is what they got for a treatment from the studio. In the original script, Regan, who is also Pazuzu, she turns into a temptress, which then inspires Father Lamont to rape her. So they had this whole rape sequence where the father rapes Linda Blair. They were told immediately, you got to take that out. That's just not going to work. This script gets rewritten like 100 times on set, and they try to stick it in there again. And it got so uncomfortable at a point where Linda Blair was like, I'm a 16-year-old girl. I'm not going to, you know, have this priest rape me. Look, they were desperate. They, you know, that was a whole nother thing. He was 53 years old. She was 16. So, yeah. And so they got Goodhart. He's working on the new script. He's rewriting it, making sure it's tailored to Warner Brothers expectations. So WB, they've got this ace in the pocket. Stanley Kubrick owes them a movie. So they think in their little mind that they're going to be able to convince Stanley Kubrick to direct the sequel to The Exorcist. Okay. I mean, look, this is all documented. It went down. They figured he would be their secret weapon. And even if it was shit, it would still be a Stanley Kubrick movie. So it'd still have some kind of artistic merit. Wisely, Stanley turns down the offer to direct. Obviously, Sir John Borman, who becomes the director of The Exorcist to The Heretic, he accepts to take the film. Kubrick warned him, and he said the only way to make a sequel to The Exorcist and for it to work would be it would have to be more graphic and horrific than the original. And I'm not the type of director who is willing to take it that far. And he's right. He's right, because at that point with The Exorcist, it was shock and awe. You can only double down on that. And unfortunately, I don't even know how you would get a film like that made. Can you imagine a more graphic version of The Exorcist, especially being released in 1973? No. So Sam Osteen had initially agreed to direct the film, but he never attached himself directly to the production. But when British filmmaker Sir John Borman signed on, he was more interested in making a spiritual thriller, a metaphysical thriller. The studio mandated that this be called The Exorcist 2. He just wanted to call it The Heretic. And it was going to be like a spiritual successor, a spinoff to the original film, another adventure, but dealing with different parameters and different themes. Unfortunately, he wouldn't get his way. To be perfectly honest with you, Borman, he had been scouted by WB to be the original director for The Exorcist, and he turned down the screenplay because he said it was repulsive. However, he was intrigued with the idea of directing a sequel. Every film has to struggle to find a connection with its audience, and he saw an opportunity to make an extremely ambitious film on the studio's dime, and he thought that he could take a really interesting cinematic journey with the viewers on this one. Look, who is John Borman? Probably wondering. Deliverance, Excalibur, one of my favorites, Zardos, The Emerald Forest, that's another 80s banger. Borman is a great filmmaker. There's no unequivocal doubt that this guy makes great movies. Excalibur's fantastic. If you haven't watched that one or you haven't watched it in a long time, definitely. He uses a lot of practical in-camera effects, and I gotta tell you, especially on Excalibur, a movie that's about fantasy and, you know, sword and sorcery type of stuff, it really works. I love his stuff on Zardos. It's cheesy, but it's lovable. So how do we get this thing cast? Who are we going to put in this movie? So Linda Blair, she gets the honk honk, the dump truck full of money. They're just like, listen, if you're going to do The Exorcist 2, you got to have the little girl, right? You got to have Linda Blair. She refused to wear demon makeup. So a double was used for the flashbacks and some of the sequences. That's an entirely different actress, and it's weird. I don't know. For some reason, it doesn't look right. She said there's no way. There's one scene where she puts on contacts to do the green eye effect. But other than that, she was like, listen, she's like, I'll do whatever you want in this movie, but I'm not putting on the makeup. Now, Max von Sydow was persuaded by Borman to reprise the role of Father Marin, and he didn't want to come back because of his concerns of the negative impact of that first Exorcist film, because at that point, it kind of haunted him. He was having trouble getting other roles because everybody saw him as Father Marin. Kitty Wynn, she re-signed on to reprise the role of Sharon Spencer. Ellen Burstyn flatly refused to return as Crisp McNeil. She was like, no, I'm not coming back. I don't care. Apparently, for whatever it was, they couldn't reach an agreement monetarily wise. But it's funny because we have Exorcist Believer coming out. And and now they, like I said, it was said to Pete before. I was like, the money runs out. It dries up, you know, or stuff happens in life. You know, your grandkids want to go to college. So you do another Exorcist, whatever. Who cares? So Borman contacted William O'Malley to reprise his role as Father Joseph Dyer from the first film. However, O'Malley was busy. He couldn't take up the part of Father Dyer, and it was changed to Father Philip Lamont. Now, Richard Burton obviously gets the role, but who read for this part? Because it was a big deal. And to be honest, Richard Burton's 53. He's trying to make a comeback. He was doing Equius on Broadway. He's doing whatever he can to kind of hold. He went through a bad divorce, really bad divorce with Liz Taylor. I think it affected him. And the other thing too was Richard Burton, notorious drunk. I'm sorry. Like, and I hate to put that out there, but that's a big part of the story. So who read? Now, John Voight read for the part. David Carradine, Jack Nicholson, and Christopher Walken. They all did screen tests for this. Believe it or not, they wanted the one who came closest, and you're not going to believe this. Walken had a fucked up audition too. Walken had a stomach bug, and he tanked the audition. He knew he did, but it's fine. Because you know what? I don't know. I don't even think Nicholson could have made. They wanted Chris Sarandon. Chris Sarandon played the vampire in Fright Night. He's been in tons of stuff, Chris Sarandon. He's the voice of Jack, you know, Jack Skellington. The singing voice is obviously Danny Elfman. But he came the closest. They wanted to go with a young, cool, hip, a little bit hot, a little bit sexy priest. It is what it is, but supposedly Voight signed on for the role like a month before they were about to film. And he had problems with the screenplay and had some problems with Borman. So ultimately, they replaced him at the last minute with Richard Burton. Linda Blair went on record saying that Richard Burton started out as sober, but frequently became drunk during the middle and end of filming. She also says that tensions had become so high with everyone on the set and Burton with his drinking. Years later, Burton openly admitted in interviews that this was a paycheck for him. I was going through a terrible divorce with Liz Taylor. I needed money for that. I had gone into a deep depression. Started taking pills to go to sleep. This is where the drinking really becomes a problem for him. And it's sad because what happens is it affects everybody. And he has a temper. He's got a really hot head. And everybody's just walking. They're trying to walk on eggshells not to upset Richard Burton. So that's a whole, I mean, can you imagine that? This is the guy who's the lead of your film. And now everybody has to tiptoe around him because they don't want to piss him off. Gene Tuscan, this was the role that Louise Fletcher inhabits. She had just won the Academy Award for Best Actress. Literally. This is the craziest story. She signs on to do The Exorcist 2 a month before she wins the Oscar. And she goes, I'm going to do it because, you know, as an actress, you got to take whatever roles you can get. You know, you got to do what you can do to survive as a female actor in this world. So Louise Fletcher ends up winning an Oscar for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And it's literally a month after she signed on to be a part of The Exorcist. And she's like, shit. You know, like, wow. Like, what am I? She could have probably done anything she wanted. She could have wrote her own check. But you know what? She signed on to do this movie. And now she's got an obligation. And the people at Warner Brothers were fucking thrilled. They're like, you know, Exorcist 2 with award-winning actress. You know, so it's a win-win for them. Originally, the part that Louise Fletcher inhabits in this film was written for a man. and they kept trying to plug people into it. They tried George Segal, they tried a whole bunch of different people to take this role, and Borman was like, you know what, let's just turn it into a woman, and that way we don't have Ellen Burstyn, so we need someone to be the motherly figure in this movie. Principal photography begins on May 24th, 1976 at Burbank Studios. They have a budget of $8 million. The film would end up costing $12 million to make, just so we're all, yeah. Borman had wanted to go to Ethiopia, Africa. He wanted to even shoot in the Vatican. The Vatican was like, we will shoot you, literally. If you bring any kind of crew that has to do with this movie, to the, you'll be shot on site. They didn't say that, but pretty much it was it was in the subtext. All of this proved impossible. All these exotic locations that Borman, he went around the world. He scouted these locations. And they're like, no, just shoot it all on back lots here at Warner Brothers and nobody will even know. So even the McNeil House in Georgetown had to be replicated in the studio because the filmmakers were refused permission to film in the original house. In fact, everybody in Washington just wanted them the hell out of the way. They were like, please, don't come here. Don't make a movie. So they had to recreate the house on a back lot. You know, it's kind of one of these weird things. Even the filmmakers, they had to replicate the infamous Hitchcock steps that were adjacent to the McNeil house. Washington City officials were like, under no circumstances is this film to be shot anywhere near our city. Keep it away. We don't want it. It's attracted too many looky-loos, too many tourists. It still does to this day. They were done with all the tourism that The Exorcist had created. Brought a lot of shenanigans and hooligans and drunks and shit, and people were running up and down the stairs and falling down and breaking their leg. They're really steep stairs. I mean, they're there. They're still there. People go there. It's like the steps in Rocky in Philadelphia. It's kind of the horror version of that. So there was 2 weeks of shooting in New York City, which they were shooting on top of the Warner Brothers building on Fifth Avenue. They did a couple of pickup shots in Newark, New Jersey. The stuff that was shot on the roof, when you watch this movie, there's a whole sequence where Linda Blair is Reagan. She's on the roof and it's an open roof. There's no guardrail. There's nothing. Years later, Linda Blair's like, I have no idea how I agreed to do that. She was up there. She was up 20, 30 stories, and she should have had a rig on her. She should have had something, but she agreed to do it. And she went up there and Borman shot it in the afternoon. But to me, like, that's, you watch this movie and you look at those sequences where she's looking on Fifth Avenue. It's terrifying. It's terrifying because there was nothing there in place to protect this girl. It's fucking insane.
We'll be right back with more of The Offering with Jerry Horror.
Where can I get my pickles when I can't get to a farmer's market or festival? The answer is Pickle Island in Bayville, New York. Listen, I've been selling a small pickle my whole life. I know all about it. From the vine to the brine, they keep their pickles cold with a delicious, diverse selection of gourmet pickles, including their savory, classic bread and butter sweet chip, horseradish pickle, jalapeno pickle, and sweet Cajun pickle. They even got pickled beets and okra, a variety of sour treats for your next barbecue or get-together. But if you visit their store in Bayville, Long Island, New York, there's so much more, so much more. A fantastic selection of physical media, comics, music, movies, VHS, and Matt Roran, their enthusiastic pickle salesman. It's kind of a big deal. Check them out now at HormansBestPickles.com. Hey, quit jerking your gherkin and head over to Pickle Island in Bayville, New York. Insomnomaniacs, join the chat monsters and fellow miscreants of the Midnight Hour for the Gooligans YouTube live stream for a wild night flight of retro commercials, vintage trailers, indie short films, horror comedy, weird music videos, and featuring the occasional Matt Roran appearances. Horror hosted by your favorite funny monsters, the Ghouligans, as they stream a live online visual arts magazine and variety television show of the likes rarely ever seen, while also hosting live chat-along viewings of such other horror classic films like Carnival of Souls, House on Haunted Hill, The Brain That Wouldn't Die, The Werewolf of Washington, and one of my favorites, Manos, The Hands of Fate. This is late night television the way you remembered. Subscribe to the Ghouligans YouTube channel and make sure to click on that notification bell so that you won't miss the next Ghouligans YouTube live stream. You're listening to The Offering with Jerry Hara. Got a question or a story you want to share with me? It might be featured in a future episode. Email me at jerryhara@gmail.com or hit me up on Twitter @jerryhara. I'm also on Instagram. You can find me there @jerryhara. Rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts, and you might find your review in an upcoming episode. And if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to The Offering. Now back to the show. Borman was really unhappy with Goodhart's script. He says to Goodhart, "Can you do a rewrite? I got some ideas from some old religious texts I've found." So Goodhart refuses, and he tells Borman to go fuck himself. And then the script ends up being rewritten by Rospo Pallenberg and John Borman himself. Goodhart's script was constantly being rewritten as the film was shooting, and the filmmakers were uncertain as how this whole story should end. Even Linda Blair, she went on record, she said this was a really good script at first, and then everybody signed on and they rewrote it 5 times, and it ended up nothing like the script that everybody had written. Louise Fletcher said the same thing. Even Richard Burton said it. Everybody was like, by the time they were done making this movie, it had been rewritten so many times that it was a different movie. There were numerous problems, obviously, on this film. This is really weird. So again, cursed film. Borman contracted a case of San Joaquin Valley fever, which is a respiratory fungal infection. This canceled production for a month. It was an incredibly costly delay. Other problems were like footage being oversaturated and necessitating reshoots. The locusts. There's a ton of locusts in this movie. They had 25,000 locusts were shipped in and died at a rate of 100 a day. They used real locusts. Basically, the original editor, John Merritt, he quit the production. He was replaced by Tom Priestley, who was Jason Priestley's grandfather. Basically, Kitty Wynn, she was the character from the first one, and Louise Fletcher both got gallbladder infections the same week, and they got pulled off the movie for about 2 weeks. How weird is that? How does that happen? Two women, two different ages, they both got gallbladder infections. So now you got the directors out for a month. Two of the primary actresses, they're out for another 2 weeks. The movie's just burning money because they were shooting on these sound stages. They were taking up a ton of space over at Warner. Eventually what happens is Pallenberg did so many rewrites that he got credited as the second unit director and creative associate because they didn't want a big fight with the WGA. So they were just like, you know what? Make this guy a producer, give him a creative associate credit, and we'll just say that John Borman rewrote the screenplay. So the original rough cut, the work print of this movie, was 3 hours long. And amongst the scenes that were deleted from the final version, there was a special effects sequence with the African church being destroyed by the demon, as well as a very hokey and trippy opening showing the demon traveling through New York City telekinetically. Studio was so pissed and bewildered. This special effects sequence of the demon terrorizing the African church, they shot it like a kaiju movie, and it just looked cheap and crappy, and it was a stop-motion demon. At this point, Warner Brothers is like, what have we done? We've overspent by $4 million. The director's disappeared. Everybody's miserable. Richard Burton. And now, this is even worse. Poor old Richard Burton. He's got nothing to do. He's on set. He's got nothing to do. He's got no director. He's got no co-stars. So he just keeps on drinking. A lot of his stuff in the movie, it's very obvious that it's ADR'd. Oh, shit. I forgot to bring this up, too. Richard Burton's character, the priest, he was supposed to have a sidekick, and they couldn't find one. They did a scene with Ned Beatty, who had worked with Borman on Deliverance. And there's this whole sequence with him that goes nowhere. He flies him over to somewhere in Africa, but it's ridiculous because they were trying to get him a sidekick. And Ned Beatty was like, listen, I'm going to do this as a favor for the day, but I'm not going to play the sidekick. So there's this whole little scene in the movie where they're over like somewhere in France and we're like, oh shit, Ned Beatty's here. Like we got something going on. And he just, he's like, I'm out of the movie. So that sidekick character just, I don't know what happened, but Ned Beatty went to go make Superman with Dick Donner, director of The Omen. So it's time that we get to the infamous test screening, because this is really where everything goes off the rails. William Friedkin, obviously director of the first film, he told a story recalled by a Warner Brothers executive at the Chicago Critics Film Festival. Basically, studio heads came to see the sneak preview of Exorcist 2 in a limo, and they told the drivers to get fast food. So they enter the auditorium, and within 10 minutes, this is 10 minutes into the movie, an audience member stood up in the screening, glanced into the crowd, and proclaimed, "The people who made this piece of shit are in the room." So 10 or 12 other audience members, they gather, and they start forming like a lynch mob to find the executives. So the studio heads, people are literally starting to riot. They're throwing their popcorn. They're getting rowdy. The studio people, the heads, they rushed out of the theater and they realized that the limo drivers had went to go get fast food. So they're trying to just make their escape and they're being chased down the street by the people who were pissed off, the theater patrons. It's a real fucking thing that happened. It's wild, man. Can you imagine showing a movie and people like just rioting? Full on, like, fuck, it's those, like, coming and, it's just, I can't imagine that. So they have the premiere in New York. The premiere in New York doesn't go well. It's another situation where, like, 15 minutes into the movie, people are laughing, and then William Peter Blatty, who is the author of the original novel, he had to stifle his own laughter. And he came out and the press is like, you know, what did you think? What did you think? And he couldn't stop laughing and just walked away and didn't give anybody a press quote. This is really weird. The Heretic was Warner Brothers' largest day and date launch, opening in 725 theaters in the United States and Canada. And it set an opening weekend record for Warner Brothers with $6.7 million, but poor word of mouth hampered its performance. Now, despite all the stuff that went on during this movie, I gotta tell you, I gotta talk about the tap dancing. And there's a few other things I gotta talk about here. Linda Blair, she's 16. She does not wear a bra in this movie. Not once. Not ever. They write in this whole thing about tap dancing. And she didn't know how to tap dance. And they paid her to go learn how to tap dance for 2 months because Borman said it had to be in the movie. I don't know what the story was with that. She really didn't want to do it. She's at that weird age, you know, where she wants to probably sink her teeth in some roles that are for older women. And she has that baby face. She's got those chubby cheeks and she still looks like a little cherub. But I think that the studio didn't know what they wanted. The whole scene with her seducing the father and all that stuff, it was really in poor taste, in such poor taste that both her and Burton, they were going to walk off the movie and claim breach of contract because they didn't want to do that scene. It's just crazy that that was originally in the script and then it ends up being written out and then they've kind of like, they've painted themselves into a corner and they're like, oh, we'll just put it back into the script. The problem was that Blair and Burton weren't going to do it. Look, I'm sorry, I had to backtrack a little bit there, but just follow me. Now, this film eventually goes on to gross $30 million in the United States. It turns a profit, but it's still disappointing in comparison to the original film's gross. This is the other thing, okay? People have said, oh, well, it's the worst horror sequel of all time. It's not entirely fair, because I have discovered that Exorcist 2, The Heretic, is not a horror movie. It's a psychological thriller. It's a spiritual thriller. It has metaphysical things. I mean, like, a lot of this movie has to deal with telekinesis. There's like this consciousness. There's consciousness for good and for bad, hive minds. Everyone has to be on the same frequency. But the problem is, if they're not ready to commit to it, to create peace, dude, there's all this weird metaphysical shit in this movie. I think Borman had some really good ideas. I think Goodhart had some really good ideas. Unfortunately, they just don't flesh out. There is some really heady stuff in here, some very trippy stuff in this movie. We're not even sure. All the stuff that goes down with James Earl Jones when he goes to Africa, and then he turns in from like a native chief, and then he turns into the man working in the lab. Is it the same person? Is it reality? We're not quite sure, because all of this is metaphorical mumbo jumbo. And to be perfectly honest with you, most people didn't understand this movie. Let me be even more honest. I've watched this movie twice in the last 48 hours, and I'm not quite sure exactly what to make out of it. This is the first movie that has stumped me. Part of me really likes this movie, and there's really cool stuff. There's filmmaking happening. But then the other half of it is just like, what the fuck are we doing? And I think the second that they had to call this The Exorcist 2, the movie was done. There was no coming back from it. Linda Blair has gone on record. She said, this is one of the biggest disappointments of my career. It was really upsetting. I was humiliated. I was humiliated by the reviews. And Borman even commented, the sin that I committed was not giving the audience what it wanted in terms of horror. That's the wild beast out there, which is the audience. I created this arena, and I just didn't throw enough Christians into it. I mean, look, who knows where the blame ultimately lies? Was it Borman's illness, constant revising of the script, a drunk lead actor, not a character? All of these events alone, it's not enough to say, well, this is why this film's an almighty failure. Borman has gone on to produce great films. It happens. Look, there is a confluence of events and things that happen regarding The Exorcist 2, and there's just no turning back. In contrast, noted critic Pauline Kael preferred Borman's sequel to the original. Writing in her review in The New Yorker, Exorcist 2 had more visual magic than a dozen movies. And this is the other thing. This movie is a feeding frenzy for the press, because everyone who either loved or hated The Exorcist, they needed to chime in with their two cents, because it's like, The Exorcist is one of the biggest movies of all time. This is the sequel. Everybody's there. We're all showing up. Gene Siskel of the Chicago Tribune gave the film 0 out of 4 stars and declared it the worst major motion picture that I've seen in almost 8 years on the job. Borman knew it. It's audience expectations. It could never live up to what the movie that you have in your head about the sequel to The Exorcist is going to be far more engaging and scarier than anything that they're going to commit to celluloid. I promise you that. As of July 2023, Exorcist 2 had a 10% rating on review aggregator Rotten Tomatoes. The average rating is 3.6 out of 10. The consensus for the site read, hokey mystical effects, lousy plotting, and worse acting directly tarnishes the first film's chilling legacy. Look, there's a lot of hokey stuff, but there's good stuff in this movie, and that's why I'm so torn. I can't outright hate this movie, because I love movies, and I love filmmaking, and I love when somebody, an auteur like Borman, he's trying to say something with this. I don't know if he knows quite right how to say it, but he's working shit out on screen, and that's admirable. Believe it or not, when this movie came out, it came in number 2 at the box office. What was number 1? It was Jacqueline Bisset and Nick Nolte in The Deep. It was based on the Peter Benchley novel that, hey, look, everybody wanted to see Jacqueline Bisset in a swimsuit, and they liked, you know, they liked Peter Benchley's novels. And The Deep is a spiritual sequel to Jaws, because obviously it, deals with aquatic adventures. But yeah, I mean, so that's number one at the box office. Exorcist II: The Heretic is number two at the box office. It has this huge opening weekend, but the second weekend, it's like a 60 to 70% drop off. Whereas the first movie was catapulted by word of mouth, the word of mouth on The Heretic just absolutely killed the movie. Here's another thing. A little film 2 weeks earlier came out called Star Wars. And despite what Disney and their propaganda machine will have you believe, Star Wars came out as May 25th as a limited engagement. It spread to more theaters as word of mouth took off and it grew into this monster. So anybody who tells you like, oh, Star Wars, it took time. It took time. You know, releasing schedules were different back then, especially in the 70s. So this is the weirdest part of this whole story, to me at least, to me. There's multiple cuts of this movie. There's the 3-hour work print. There's the version that John Borman released into theaters. And then there's a third version. So here's what happens. The movie goes out to all these cinemas, right? It's in theaters. It's rocking. The major change that Warner Brothers mandated, they mandated Borman to do this. In the original ending, the father just gets killed. He gets killed and that's it. In the new ending, the one that most of us have seen, he walks away and kind of has a happy ending and he's going to protect Reagan, go on to have more adventures. It's funny because this whole movie feels like a TV pilot. It feels like, oh, the further adventures will continue of The Exorcist. So what does Warner Brothers do? They recall the prints. A dozen prints at a time, they go. They change the movie. They put in the different ending. They change some other things. And they put it back out into theaters. And guess what? People still don't like it, but it happened. And it's the most bizarre thing because it's the only time a major studio film had put out that many prints of a movie and then recalled them. And not that they changed it. They had the original director go back and change it. That's insane. It's never happened since. It blows my mind. Hey, physical media nerds, you know what time it is. Came out in VHS in 1983. The Laserdisc was only manufactured in Japan, and it's become super rare. So if you ever find an Exorcist II Laserdisc, time to sell it. This movie didn't come to DVD until 2002. I mean, hell, look, I'll be honest with you. Even before I saw The Exorcist, I saw the original here on WPIX Channel 11. I saw it as a late show. I stayed up late and watched The Exorcist. I didn't even know a sequel existed. I didn't. For many years, I had no idea. I finally came to Blu-ray in 2014. In 2018, Shout Factory released a special edition. This is the best version of the film to date. It has all new special features. Spend the $20, the $30, get the Shout Factory version because it's got all kinds of good stuff. Definitely recommend it. Fun fact, this film, along with The Exorcist 1973 and The Exorcist 3 in 1990, were serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer's favorite films. One of his surviving victims recalls seeing him watch The Exorcist 2 repeatedly in a trance-like state. I mean, that's the biggest, that's the greatest endorsement you can get. Everybody loves those serial killers, especially when they're played by hunky boys. Right? That's what it's all about. We get hunky boys to play serial killers. That's the formula. The film itself is one of Martin Scorsese and Quentin Tarantino's favorites. In fact, Tarantino used Reagan's theme for his film, The Hateful Eight. He also, because it's Ennio Morricone. And I will say this, the best part of this movie is Ennio Morricone's score. It's so good. And it's crazy too, because Morricone had a bunch of unused stuff from The Thing, and that ended up in The Hateful Eight. Quentin Tarantino just repurposed all the... He's like, what do you got laying around? He's like, I got some stuff from The Exorcist 2, and I got some stuff from The Thing. All right, fine, make it. That's fine. Okay, we'll do it. Truth be told, the score is probably the best thing, in my opinion, is the best thing about this movie, the score. Now, we're going to do this. We got the unhinged review. Let me just get into it. Does great goodness bring upon itself great evil? This goes back to the book of Job. It's God testing the good In this sense, Reagan is a modern-day saint, like Ingrid Bergman, Europa 51. It's like Charlie in Mean Streets. I liked the first Exorcist because of the Catholic guilt that I have, and because it scared the hell out of me. The Heretic surpasses it. Maybe John Borman failed to execute the material, but the movie still deserved better than it got. It's a masterpiece. Martin Scorsese. A few months after this review, Martin Scorsese went to rehab for a very serious cocaine addiction. Folks, I'm Jerry Hara. I'm on social media. Hit me up on X. Hit me up on IG. Hit me up on TikTok. I'm everywhere. The show is everywhere. Leave a review, you know? And hey, we've done a lot of great episodes this season. And I'm going to plug the hell out of them. We've done a lot of good, sick plug. Bro, did you hear Jerry's plugs on the last show? Crazy, bro. He is legit. No cap. For real. For real. Yo, I don't know, man. Nobody wants to follow something that's iconic. And that's the thing, man. Had this film just been called The Heretic and been kind of a spiritual successor, it might have worked. But I'm going to be honest with you. Nothing was going to make this movie work. Once the studio mandated that it said Exorcist 2, it was done. And I will tell you this. The Exorcist 2 is not the worst sequel of all time, the horror sequel. It's not a horror movie. I'm telling you, there's so many elements of weird stuff like transgressive. There's themes in this movie that you would later see in the X-Men films about hive minds and all kinds of other stuff. The world was probably not ready for this movie, but also The Exorcist is a horror film. And I think Borman and everybody involved, they realized we should have just played it a little bit close to the vest and gave them more of the same. But if they did that, would we be here right now talking about it? Probably not. And I think that is the greatest gift that Exorcist 2, The Heretic, gives us, is that all these years later, we're still talking about it. There's books on it. I listened to a podcast. I don't even remember who it was. They did 5 hours on this movie. Just 5 hours of three people drilling into it. And I don't know exactly what I even ascertained from that experience. But I do know this. If you're curious, give it a watch. It's a definite recommend. But as I stated, I hate this film and I love this film. And I can't stop thinking about this film. So in that, Sir John Borman has succeeded because his film has in some way gotten inside my head and infested it like a disease, and I can't get it out. And if that's not good filmmaking, I don't know what is. So, dear listener, I leave you to decide for yourself. Is Exorcist 2, The Heretic, the worst horror sequel of all time? Let me know. You got the social medias. And if Exorcist 2, The Heretic, is not the worst horror sequel of all time, what is? What's the worst sequel? What's the worst horror sequel you can think of? Because I want to know what it is. All right? I have theories, I have opinions, but I want to hear yours. What's the worst horror sequel of all time? Go. You know where to go. Come on, if you're listening to this, just let me know. Let me know. Until then, I'm Jerry Hara. This has been The Offering. Mostly horror, always genre.
You've been listening to The Offering with Jerry Hara. I'm very sorry. Produced by Pete Bune. If you have a question or a story you want to share with me, we'd love to hear from you. You can email me at jerryhara@gmail.com or hit us up at Twitter @jerryhara or on Instagram @jerryhara. You getting the picture? Subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts are provided for you and your family. I want you to enjoy. Just join us next time for another offering.
This has been a Sick Boy Wolfgang production. Thank you for listening.